Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. That sweet tone, my friend, is the tone of Sonny Rollins. I've got to tell you back about 1958. I was sitting at the Five Spot Cafe, a little place down on 3rd Street and 3rd Avenue, or 5th Street and 3rd Avenue, where watching Thelonious Monk every night. And then all of a sudden, you know, in walks Sonny Rollins, and everybody says, "Oh, it's Sonny Rollins. I've heard about him." Gets up on stage and proceeds to do this to my poor young brain. So I would play that for you forever, and I will spend my time talking to you about that. In the studio with me today is Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, welcome here.
What a pleasure to be here today.
Isn't it a pleasure? And through the good graces of Kent Robert Shaw and his efforts, we were able to reconnect with the one and only Sonny Rollins. Sonny, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Oh, boy, is that nice to hear. Sonny, tell me about your history with WBAI before we go further, because I know when they invited you, you said, "WBAI, I'll be there."
Well, you know, when I lived in New York City, which I don't anymore, but when I did, WBAI was my station, and I listened to it on a regular basis. I remember my friend Samori Marksman, and I used to listen to Amy Goodman and some other people. And it was really a beacon in the wasteland of commercial radio, as you know. So I really enjoy WBAI, and I'm sorry that I'm unable to pick it up where I live now, which is quite a distance from the city.
And it was something that was a great deal of meaning to you, but you've always been very conscious of what goes on in this planet and with the differences between commercial radio and public radio, and so you've recently been focusing a great deal on global warming. Can you tell me what your interest is in global warming?
Well, my interest in global warming is more of an interest in an individual's lifestyle. I think that a lifestyle which you dispose of garbage and you trample on things and just keep going on. I mean, there's something which to me is not correct about living that type of lifestyle. Global warming represents that because we sort of use everything that we have here, and then never mind the consequences. So, I mean, it's sort of a life without any guidelines, you know, without right or wrong.
Yeah, this is Kent, Sonny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that you have a strong spiritual background, and I would assume that protecting Mother Earth and not ruining Mother Earth is a big part of your philosophy about life.
Yeah, right. I don't want to ruin Mother Earth. I don't want to ruin, human beings, anybody. I mean, I'd like to live on this planet, as I have said and that others have said, living lightly on the planet. So, you know, I don't want to cause a lot of pain for anybody, including myself. This is how I feel about global warming, you know.
And you've certainly been through enough pain in your life. But, you know, when you were a kid and growing up in Harlem, there was you had a number of people around you who were also conscious of what was happening and politically active, didn't you?
Well, I had a lot of young musician friends. As far as the political part, my grandmother was the political activist in our family, and as a small child, I was going to Paul Robeson rallies and rallies against things like lynching in different parts of the South. I remember the Scottsboro Boy cases and marching up and down Lenox Avenue and 7th and my grandmother was also Garveyite, you know. So we were into the whole movement about human rights.
Now, your grandmother was, I mean, you're watching your grandma march up and down, and you're following along like a little kid down, you know, during these streets. It wasn't a confusing time to you. You actually understood what was going on.
Yeah.
You had a sense of it.
Right, I had a sense of it. Even, I mean, I was small, but I knew it was something. You know, there was a urgency about it, and the people were. As a matter of fact, when I grew up in Harlem, we used to go up and down Harlem, and there used to be people that would put up a soapbox.
Oh, yes, I remember the soapboxes.
And they put up their soapbox and talk, you know.
Sure, they would
and
just...
Go ahead.
Right, they would just say out what they wanted to say out.
Exactly.
And your grandmother, I mean, must have been real, real dear to you, right?
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever write any music directly to your grandmother? Are any of your pieces ever written to her?
Not specifically dedicated to her, but she is responsible for me being the person I am today. So in a way of speaking, everything I do is dedicated to her.
So wherever Grandma is right now, if she's up in the ethers listening to us and this broadcast through a satellite, which she very well may be doing, Sonny Rollins gives a nod. Hey,
that's
Grandma.
Right.
Hey, Grandma.
Right.
What did you call it, by the way?
Grand.
Hey, Grand, wherever you are, Sonny's saying hello. He did good for himself. All right. Now, Kent, I know you, my friend Kent has a question for you about your
Yeah, I just was reading some of your biography, Sonny, and I saw that sort of your personal involvement in civil rights and the black movement intersected with music, because I understand in high school you were bused to a mixed school with whites and blacks, and there was a great deal of tension. And I read that some very important musical figures came to your school to try to settle things, to promote peace, to promote love, to promote harmony in a time when, sadly, there was not enough of that going on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we were bused. This might have been the first busing. I'm not sure, but I guess it must have been around 1945 or so. At any rate, my family had moved up on Sugar Hill at that time, and we were living up around 155th Street. And I was going to a high school up, you know, and so after we matriculated, use a fancy word there for coming out of junior high school, we were bused. There was a new high school opening up on 116th Street and Pleasant Avenue. right in the center of Little Italy. And there's a brand new high school opening up there, Benjamin Franklin High School. And so I guess they had to fill that high school. I don't know exactly what the social engineering might have been, they might have been trying to accomplish. But at any rate, we were all sent down. That was our high school. And so every day, you know, we took the A train. Maybe it was the AA train down to 116th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue there, got out and took the crosstown bus all the way over to Pleasant Avenue, which was the last avenue before the East River. And, you know, it was an Italian neighborhood. It was... a lot of the people sort of felt they were being invaded, I guess, with all these kids coming from another neighborhood, you know. And so there was a lot of fights, a lot of people throwing stuff out the window at us. We walking over to, you know, I mean, it was just a whole lot of turmoil. And, you know, not be embarrassed. Also, I think it was very good that the city tried to do something about it. And we were, they have Frank Sinatra was a big star at that time, you know, pretty big name at that time. Come over to our school and give a concert right there in our school auditorium. And Frank Sinatra also spoke about the needs for people to get along with each other, and that this was a wrong thing to do all this time. Of course, Frank Sinatra was a idol among these Italian people over there. So that was very good. And then a couple of weeks later, Nat King Cole, the King Cole Trio, came down, played at our school, at our school auditorium. So, I mean, this was great. And after that, tensions eased to a great extent, and we were integrated more readily into the community, at least, you know, for school hours. I mean, after we just went over to go to school and we integrated into the school circumstances, and it was a good lesson, really, and it kind of showed how modern entertainment figures, that artists can speak out and have a positive effect, which is something W.E.B. Du Bois always said, that an artist has a responsibility to speak out about social matters. It's just not about his career. So in that case, Nat King Cole and the fabulous King Cole Trio and Frank Sinatra both did that, and it made our entry into Benjamin Franklin High School smooth.
So there you are, and about 12 years old, going to Benjamin Franklin High School with Frank Sinatra. At some point later, didn't you have an opportunity to play with Frank Sinatra? Didn't you ever get a chance?
No, I never.
You never met him?
No, I never met Frank Sinatra. I never played with Frank Sinatra. I I had met Nat King Cole when I was a little boy, and he used to stay at a friend of mine's house, the great Andy Kirk, the band leader. And when Nat Cole came to town to play at the Apollo and different places, they would stay, and Nat would stay up at Andy Kirk's apartment up on Edgecombe Avenue. And as a matter of fact, Andy Kirk had a son, Andy Kirk Jr., who was our friend, and so he used to be up at the house. And I shouldn't say I met King Cole, but I saw him when he was up there in the apartment. I mean, we were little kids, you know, really. But I have a tremendous amount of admiration for him. I think he's one of our great musicians. But, no, I never got a chance to meet Nat Cole, actually, although I did get a chance to play for him later when I was playing with Clifford Brown and Max Roach. We played at a club in Washington, D.C., on G Street one night, and Nat Cole was in the house.
When you were young and when you were at that age, somebody must have impressed you as being, you know, you, at one point you had to turn around and say, I think I'll play a tenor saxophone. How did that happen?
Well, I was around 7 years old, I would say. I was, I used to stay with my uncle sometimes. So my uncle and his girlfriend, whose name was Lizzie. So Lizzie had all these great jazz records and blues records. The house, I used to listen to all these records, you know, I was around 6 or 7 years old. I really got into Louis Jordan, who was a great, what they would call rhythm and blues performer. He was sort of an entertainer in a sense, but he was a great musician. He had a great band, Louis Jordan and the Timpani Five. It was a sax, trumpet, piano, drums, and bass. And I really got it. And then there was a lot of records. I had records, you know. I even before that, I grew up in a musical household. My older brother played classical violin. He was trained. My older sister, she sang in church and everything. And so I heard a lot of music when I was, you know, coming out of the womb almost. And being up in Harlem, there was so much music around. You know, Fats Waller used to play right across the street from one of the places he used to live at on 135th Street. And there's all these, every place, you know, music was all over Harlem, great music. And I heard a lot of it as a child. But when I first began liking the saxophone, my first idol was Louis Jordan. And then also Louis Jordan was playing across the street from where my elementary school was. I used to go to PS 89 on 135th Street and Lenox Avenue. And right across the street, it was a nightclub called the Elks Rendezvous. So here I am. I was 6, 7 years old. And I had heard Louis Jordan, at my uncle's. So through across the street in this Elks Rendezvous, there'd be these pictures outside because Louis Jordan was playing there. And Louis Jordan was really sharp. He had on one of these cutaway tuxedos and gleaming saxophone, and you know, he's there. Well, I saw that. I said, well, that's it. That is what I'm going to be. I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to play the saxophone. So I got my directions from up above, you know, and that was it. So I guess I was in the right place at the right time.
We're talking, in case you've just tuned in, we're speaking with the great Sonny Rollins, and this is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Shaw talking about the mind of jazz, and what better guest. Kent?
Well, you know, I was reading that people in your neighborhood, Sonny, that you would, as a teenager, sit in with and hang out at the various musicians around you. And for those of you, believe it or not, Ben Franklin High School, where Sonny went, was also, at the same time Sonny was there, Kenny Drew, Art Taylor, and Jackie McLean. So these were, went to the same school as you, Sonny, but my understanding is you had around you all sorts of great musicians in your teen years. You started to, I understand you're mainly self-taught, would hang out with famous musicians in your neighborhood. Is that right?
Well, all of these guys that you mentioned were all my contemporaries, and we had, you know, we played together, we had a band, you know, and with all these guys, and Kenny Drew and Arthur Taylor and Lowell Lewis and different people, Andy Kirk Jr., you know, we were all teenagers. But we were living up on Sugar Hill, and Sugar Hill happened to be the place where all of the black elite intelligentsia and great minds in the black world lived. Thurgood Marshall, Whitney Young, W.E.B. Du Bois, Walter White, Paul Robeson lived uptown. Duke and Andy Kirk, Coleman, Hawkins, I would say 95% of the musicians and the black intelligentsia lived on what was then called Sugar Hill. And Sugar Hill was where our family moved after I was, we moved up from where I was in 35th Street there, which was sort of Harlem proper at that time. But then we moved up to the elite part of Harlem, which was Sugar Hill. So we used to see a lot of these great jazz musicians, going to work and see all these, you know. So it was really good. Then eventually we all got good enough and we began being hired by these guys. And that's how we were able to break through. And Kenny Drew began playing piano with some of the older idols. They took him down and I got a record date with one of these guys and so on and so forth. And we were able to make a smooth transition right into our chosen field.
Kind of smooth. I remember, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s when most musicians would get a date, you know, even to play a club or something, there wasn't very much money to be had. $10 seemed like a fair fee, didn't it?
$10 is probably an extravagant fee.
That was an extravagant fee, right. That was when you got a lot of money for doing it. I was watching people, you know, who would go into clubs and play. And, of course, the thing is that you're playing, the thing that you were playing. Who were the first? Did you have a musician that truly impressed you, that the day that you played with him you felt like you had just, you know, stepped up to a whole new level, or you were finally arrived? Was there one particular musician? Because I know the ones all around you were great, you know?
Right. Well, you know, Arnold, I would say that when Miles Davis hired me, that was a good career step up for me, because we had always liked Miles. Of course, listening to him with our prophet, Charlie Parker. So that was a great step up for me when Miles heard me up at a club in the Bronx, 845 Club, and Miles hired me, and that was a big career step up. I began playing with Miles, guys like John Coltrane, Kenny Clark, all those guys, and another big musician who was very instrumental to me was Thelonious Monk.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And Monk was Monk was 13 years older than I was. So Monk was, my elder. But still, it was great that he appreciated my efforts. Even I rehearsed a lot with Monk and the different bands Monk would bring down to his house there on 63rd Street. And we'd all be in the small bedroom with four guys with all sort of instruments, you know. It was really romantic as we look back on it. But Monk was a person that I learned a lot from. And
there was something about Monk's style and your style that seemed to mesh. Not mesh like they were just harmonious, but you seemed to fit in between his notes better than anybody else, in my estimation. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Thank you very much.
There was a thing that he did and a thing that you did that just worked perfectly. And
well, you know, that's funny you say that, because Monk had told his people that around that he liked me, that I was his favorite player. You know, I was his favorite saxo player. So that was quite a honor to hear coming from him. But, I mean, because he's, you know, a lot of great people played with Monk. I mean, so maybe there's something to what you say. Maybe he liked something that I did, and he appreciated the way we played together, you know. But it was nice to hear that. That gave me a lot of encouragement.
Yeah, well, it was a thing when I saw the balance of it, and I heard the balance, and everybody around would hear it. Because, you know, sometimes you would have Paul Chambers in the background working with the two of you, and you could just see it was like a perfect moment, you know, perfect moment. Now, I saw all the other greats, too, playing with Monk, and that was different. They were like stars. But when you were there, it was like everybody was a major star at once. If Art Blakey was there, it was Art Blakey. I'm trying to remember who that drummer with Monk was, who used to play so much with the I forgot his name.
Well, Blakey played a lot also.
Yeah, I know, but before, no, when he was playing in the clubs, especially down at the Five Spot, he had it'll come to me.
Philly Joe Johnson?
No, not Philly Joe Johnson. And then you also had, of course, yeah, that wonderful duet with J.J. Johnson, which was just spectacular. We are going to have take... I agree. You're beautiful. We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, I'm going to play you, Sonny Rollins, a gift of special music that you will not expect, and then we'll go back to our interview. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, my friend. Stick with us, Sonny. Hi.
Hey!
So how's that, Sonny, for a little sneaking up from the past?
If you want to have a ball, you got to go out and spend some cash. Let the good times roll. Let the good times roll. Don't care if you're young or old. Get together
and let the good times roll. That takes you back to age five.
Yeah, that's great, man.
That's Louis Jordan and his timpani band.
That's my man.
So, we're going back. We're talking with Sonny Rollins. And, Sonny, you know, if you don't mind filling us in with that early childhood stuff, just because we are shrinks and we love understanding where things come from, your dad was a military man.
My dad was a career Navy man. That's correct.
And he was a chief petty officer?
He was a chief petty officer. That's right.
What influence did he have on your choices?
Well, my father was, because he was in the Navy, he was not constantly home. So, somebody told me that my father used to play clarinet at one time, but I never knew anything about it. He never expressed that to me. But at any rate, you know, my father would come home every now and then when the fleet was in, this kind of stuff, you know, that's how it was in those days. And, I was always, of course, trying to, you know, so finally I got a chance to go with my father when my father was down at the Naval Academy at Annapolis, Maryland. That was when I was around 11 years old, and my father was in charge of the officers' club. And I used to go down there and work at Annapolis at the academy, you know, and to stay with my father. And, you know, of course I liked that. And, I used to, go into town, into Annapolis, and, there used to be a lot of bands that would come through. There used to be a couple of places called Cars Beach and Sparrows Beach, and a lot of the bands. I saw Erskine Hawkins' band there, and I'm trying to remember if I saw another band that would come through. I remember that very well because it was an older girl who used to work at the academy there. Her name was Marjorie Brown. And I was younger than her, but I had big eyes for Marjorie Brown. And what happened is when I went to see the Erskine Hawkins' band, I mean, I was younger than she could probably, you know. I tried to throw her down on the bed one time, you know. But, I mean... I'm sure I was a few years younger than, you know, women are more mature, even if we were the same age, but she was older than I was, you know. She was working at the academy at Annapolis. Anyway, when I went to see Erskine Hawkins this time at the Sparrows Beach, here was Marjorie Brown sitting up on the stand, you know, sort of, you know, with the band and all that. So I got kind of, my heart got broken, you know. I didn't get a chance to. So Marjorie Brown was really too mature for me. But anyway, I tried, and then I used to also go down to the. I remember I saw a motion picture, Cabin in the Sky, when I was down during the summer with my father in Annapolis. And that movie had a great effect on me because there was a lot of great people in that movie. I don't know if you remember the movie Cabin in the Sky.
Yeah, I sure
and
do.
Duke Ellington's band. Sure, you remember Ethel Waters.
Ethel Waters, yeah.
Bubbles, Louis Armstrong, Mantan Morland was there. It was a lot of people. Lena Horne was in there. Rex Ingram, Kenneth Spencer. It was really a great. Eddie Rochester Anderson. It was an all-star studded movie. And they had some great music in there. Music, of course, Duke, things ain't what they used to be. I think the Duke was a band playing, and they had some nice tunes by Hal Arlen, the composer. One which I became very fond of and played a lot of times, Cabin in the Sky. The rendition, of course, by the great Ethel Waters. So that was some of the experiences I had when I was away from Annapolis, you know, just going. But I had a good time. But so that was the time I had spending with my father. Then later, of course, my father left the Navy and I was growing up. By that time, I was getting ready to leave the house and go out on my own. And so, but
that must have been some tough times in there, though. That was about your roughest time, right about that time, wasn't it? When you were leaving the house, that's when you were about to go find yourself, and you went through a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, Armin, you're correct. I did get caught up in the. The drug scene, you know, I mean, like so many of us did. And it took me a while because a lot of people were doing drugs, a lot of our idols, Charlie Parker, of course, Billie Holiday, we all knew she was so. To us, it seemed like drugs was nothing really wrong with drugs. Plus, we were. As you know, jazz musicians of any race are on the edges of society. We were not accepted by society. We were looked down as outlaws. So we reinforced that, I think, in our own minds and said, okay, well, we're outlaws, so then we're outlaws. And I think a lot of guys use drugs almost as a badge of courage, as a way to get back at the society.
Yeah, and yeah, to get back at the society on one hand, but on the other hand, what you were saying about as I remember. The family of the jazz people, and I had a similar kind of thing. We used to hang around in a room together, and it would be, you know, it would be people who would be the neighborhood likes, and they were all jazz musicians. And, of course, the drugs kind of brought the family together. It was almost like an Italian family having spaghetti. You know, it was like a thing that people did. And it was, you're right, it's a little outside the law. And it's a little grungy to do, but it felt like almost the family blood during that time. Am I very far away from what the experience was?
That sounds very much right on.
Yeah. It's what propelled me to get out of the jazz world. It's what got me to run away because I got scared by it. You know,
right.
But I watched all my friends.
Well, it took a lot of people. We lost a lot of lot of great musicians I know I ran across that succumbed, you know, and people just that couldn't handle it.
Now, I know you've talked about it before, but, you know, just because it's something we deal with a lot here on the radio, what was the deciding moment that made you reverse your position, not just on drugs, but what turned your head around, Sonny? What was it? Was there a moment? Was there an insight? Was there a kibosh? Was there your lovely wife? What was it that just kind of said to you, I can't do it this way, I got to do it another way?
Well, I got off of drugs before I met my wife, but just about before I just got. But in my case, I had gotten degraded and dehumanized by the being hooked, you know, having to get money to get that fix every day. I mean, you know, you'd do a lot of things I'm very ashamed of now. And I was ashamed of it then, even though I knew I had to do it. And but I had gotten to a bad state. I mean, I've often told people would see Sonny Rollins coming down the street, and they'd turn, go the other way, because I had gotten a bad reputation, as bad a reputation in the jazz world as probably anybody out there. And, you know, and we were following our idol, Charlie Parker, and so on. But I had a bad name as he did as far as using drugs. And here I am, his disciple, you know.
Well, you know the name.
But, excuse me?
The reputation you had at the time was, for most of us listening, it was Sonny's gone for now. We hope he could come back. Is kind of the feeling that we had, because, you know, the reputation was there, and we watched it with a number of musicians. Well, he's gone off that edge. We hope he can come back. And, boy, when you came back with such new beauty that it kind of made such a testimony to man's spirit and man's will. Kent had a question about your relationship with Charlie Parker. What?
Yeah, I hope the listeners understand when we're talking about 1953 or so, we're talking about Sonny. He must be 23 years old, and he's considered one of the great saxophonists of his time. So, you know, a young man that with all this fame and all this pressure on him. But my understanding is that a recording date with Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, he said something to you, right, about your use of drugs that may have had a powerful influence?
It did have very... What happened was that I had been incarcerated for drug-related incident, and I thought it was out on a... for probationary sentence, so to speak. And during that time, I had this recording date with Charlie Parker and Miles. Now, unfortunately, I had reverted to my drug use, even though I was out and I got weak and I started using drugs again. Now, when I saw Charlie Parker at the record date, Charlie Parker, you know, knew me and all that and was really trying his best to, which is something I learned. This is where the light came on in my head. I realized that Charlie Parker was destroying because all of his young disciples were following him and doing the same thing he was doing. And this was killing him. And so what happened? Anyway, Charlie asked me you know, oh, how's everything? Because, you know, he knew my story and everything. So I lied to him. I tell him, oh, I'm better now. You know, I was away and everything is good now. And then somebody at the record day read it on me to Charlie Parker and tell him, oh, no, Sonny is still indulging. You know, so anyway, the way Charlie Parker looked, this is when I realized that him having this whole army of young aspiring players behaving like him was really destroying him. So anyway, I got the message, and I checked myself into a sort of place which is like the Betty Ford Clinic of its day. And I finally got myself straight, and I was very determined that I would see Charlie Parker and let him know that, hey, man, look, I got you. I'm straight. I'm not messing around, you know, and there's hope. Don't feel so bad about it. But, of course, that chance never happened because Charlie Parker messed himself up so bad that he's, you know, passed before I got out of this place I was at. So anyway, Charlie Parker and I'd say my mother were about the only people, were the two people that sort of were, I knew I had to quit for my mother because my mother stayed with me when everybody else was, you know, that's one place I could always go to my mother's house.
A little later.
Excuse me?
Yeah, and later on, you were able to finally, you found the love of your life. And I know it's not a, I just think to myself, I know 2.5 years ago or 2 years ago or so, your wife passed. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was that for you, Sonny? I mean, what happened? I mean, here you are at this point in your life.
Well, you know, I'm still sort of dealing with that right now because we were together I would say over 40 years. Yeah. And you know, we had a little breakup for a couple of months, but I mean, we were together for 40 years. Over 40 years. And so, you know, it's hard because we were close in every way. And not only that, but we were two people that didn't care for the crowd. You know, we moved up here in the country and we enjoyed being alone. And we had our own life, you know. I thought we took what jobs we needed to take and I wanted to take and so on. We just had a perfect life. She loved doing the books and helping me with the recording, everything. We were partners in everything. And then I had my freedom to practice all day, read my books, just sort of live the life that nourished my soul. And unfortunately, nothing lasts forever in this life. This is just a short moment that we have here anyway on this planet. But and we have these temporary. Life is temporary. And if, unfortunately, my idyllic existence came to an end, but, you know, it's one of those things that, I mean, we all have to face these things. That's part of life. And right at the moment, I'm still going through a sort of a transition period. And, you know, trying to remember the best and keep playing, keep my music, which is always there in a way. I've never lost that. Whatever, wherever I go, wherever I do, music is always my companion. So, I'm, you know, dealing with that now, and I'm happy. I have nothing to be unhappy about. In fact, I've lived an extremely unique life, you know, being involved in music, what I love doing, all these great musicians I've known and played with, and, you know, so actually I consider myself an extremely, extremely, extremely fortunate person, and I'm very grateful for that. So, yeah, my life with my wife in this present existence has faded, but I'm sure it'll be continued other places, other times.
Well, maybe she's hooked up with Granny up there, you know, with Grands, and the two of them are sitting down looking at you, and they're saying, you know, there's our boy. There's our boy. I know you still keep Lucille on your answering machine. You know, when I called you at home, I got her voice on the answering machine, and I said, oh, man, that's beautiful.
Well, you know, and I have a very metaphysical approach to life, and so that, as I said, life is very short. It's really just this, you know, we don't have a lot of time to kind of do so much that needs to be done, so that we don't look at life as being an end, as just a comma. It's not a period.
That's certainly the lesson of lessons. Sonny Rollins, I want to thank you so much. You know, I mean, probably we could do this for hours, and with your good graces, I'm going to impose on you for maybe another interview. We could talk a little more, you know? I would love to be able to carry this on with you. Unfortunately, okay, We're just about running out of time.
Okay.
Hi, and we here at WBAI certainly love you. So I'm going to give you as a kind of a gift to Sonny Rollins. The most obvious thing for me to be doing would be to be playing Sonny Rollins' music as we go out. I mean, would you not think? But no, let's do something for Sonny and for Lucille. How about this? How about that? How about this? How about this? See how good a mechanic I am? Here it is. Sonny Rollins, you're a beautiful man.
This cloudy sky overhead now.
This is Ethel Waters singing Cabin in the Sky.
Oh, wow.
From my heart to yours, Sonny.
Oh, man, beautiful.
If I didn't know of a place we two can go, there's a little cabin in the sky, mister, for me and for you. I feel that it's true somehow. Can't you see that cabin in the sky, mister, an acre? waking every day as the angels go sailing.